This is a podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum. For further information, please go to www.rafmuseum.org/podcasts.
Your Royal Highness, Chief of the Air Staff, distinguished guests, my lords, ladies and gentlemen. As a one-time bomber pilot, I've been asked to give you a pilot's perception. But the pilot was only one of a bomber crew of seven. There were other important people in a Lancaster or a Halifax or a Stirling, all four-engine bomber planes, and they were the navigator, the flight engineer, the bomb aimer, the wireless operator, and two air gunners, all professionals and skilled at their job. A bomber crew was a unique species, a small band of brothers, not next of kin, but more closely related than any blood relations, and formed by literally being thrown together. The RAF herded a crowd of airmen into a hangar, closed the doors and said, "Get on with it, get crewed up." And we did. Although selection was mainly random, some crafty aircrew had done quiet investigations into the prowess of the pilots. And one I knew was approached by an older-than-usual air gunner who asked if he could fly with him and almost immediately produced others. Later, being curious, the pilot asked the reason, and they said they discovered he'd been in a crash and they thought he'd be more careful next time. And what perception indeed, because that crew went on to fly 70 missions together and survive. But that wasn't the fate of most crews. Some didn't even have time to unpack their kit bags. And if you took any five budding air cadets who reported to the Air Crew Reception Centre at Lord's Cricket Ground, of these five, three would become casualties and the majority would die. A number of crews completed their tours of 30 or more operations successfully, and we have several veterans here tonight who flew those tours and many more. One of our guests here tonight flew 54 trips, and another, a Pathfinder pilot, amassed 71, but they are rare examples of longevity in bomber command. Well, from Lords, most went overseas for training in Canada, the United States, South Africa, and Rhodesia, and after qualifying as a pilot or a navigator, returned to the UK, picked up a crew, as I've described, before being posted to a main force bomber squadron, of which there were more than 60 in 1945. At this point, a pilot, many only 20 years old, would have flown some 300 hours in training. And within a few days of arriving, if not before, he would see his name on the battle order for his first operation. And later, with his crew, he would join the other 140 or so members of the squadron in the briefing room. Now, behind the stage, at one end wall was covered with a large curtain, rather like a theatre. And when this was drawn back, it revealed a large-scale map of Europe. Every eye in the place fixed on a tape which ran from their airfield to a point in Germany. The target. Wow, deep breaths, sighs, groans, comments like, "Christ, not the big city, Berlin again." So back to the mess for the pre-operational meal, the best ever, bacon and eggs. Real eggs, not that powdered muck. Before returning to flights to dress for the trip. This waiting period between seeing the battle order and takeoff was probably the hardest to endure. And the ride out to dispersal before the aircraft was spread around the airfield in case of enemy attack was in a bus driven by a pretty WAF, and there's one here tonight. These buses were lit with a sickly blue light, giving everyone a look of ghastly misery, whether they felt that way or not. And clambering into a Lancaster on a winter's night was a chore because it was so narrow and constricted, so pilots soon learned to be first in. Dressed in a heavy fleece-lined Irving jacket, plus a Mae West, that inflatable jacket named after a curvaceous film actress, plus flying boots, gloves, helmet with oxygen mask and radio plug, and a parachute, one felt like the Michelin man. So you ducked past the mid-upper turret, and you barged against the damp and sharp-edged material of the fuselage, hauling oneself over the two main spars, each about 2 foot high, squeezing past the wireless operator's position and the navigator's table before stepping up to the flight deck and flopping into the pilot's seat. One was exhausted before the flight got started. Now, takeoff was always a great thrill, the feeling of power as one opened the throttles of those magnificent Merlin engines, which effortlessly lifted a 30-ton Lancaster into its element, was comforting. And then into the climb out of the North Sea and the dark eastern sky. There was much to do to prevent one's mind dwelling on what lay ahead. And what did lie ahead was a fearsome defensive system which stretched from Holland to Switzerland. A formidable system of control stations, radar units, flak batteries, searchlights concentrations, beacons, and night fighter airfields. Their radar stations had a range which meant they could detect wireless transmissions activity over our bomber bases. So any increase on a particular day with tests between air and ground was an early warning of a forthcoming air raid. So they were all alert to the oncoming bombers on different approach headings. Which was the main threat? Which were spoofs? Because Bomber Command played this game. That was the question. To the Germans, perhaps a city spared. To the bomber crews, life or death. The control centers plotted the advancing bombers and directed the night fighters who were orbiting beacons into the bomber stream. And prowling the dark skies over a blacked-out Germany were the elite of the Luftwaffe night fighter force, professional flyers, experienced and ruthless, using a deadly weapon called Schrager music. In English, jazz music, one of those many strange codes beloved of the military. Twin heavy machine guns or cameras were positioned behind the cockpits of a Messerschmitt 110 or Junkers 88 at an angle of around 65 degrees, so they were upward firing. The fighter would sneak up under the bomber about 50 or 100 yards below, open fire, and with a few shots of 30-millimeter cannons, it could literally blow this large, powerful aircraft behind me out of the sky. Perhaps the 6 fuel tanks in the wings, holding over 2,000 gallons of petrol, and the 4,000-pound bomb, and 1,500 times 4-pound incendiary bombs in the large bomb bay made a rather lethal load under such an attack. The top 10 Luftwaffe night fighter pilots alone accounted for nearly 800 British bombers. The top scorer was a Major Heinz Wolfgang Schnaufer. He was 24. On 21st of February 1945, in a Heinkel 219 fitted with Schrager music, he took just 20 minutes to shoot down 7 Lancasters. And in total, he had 121 kills, all but 4 four-engine bombers. I'm told his name was quite well known in our bomber bases. Now compare Schnaufer with our top night fighter pilot, John Cunningham, who had 20 victories. No disrespect intended, because he didn't have the opportunities that Sir Arthur Harris gave the Luftwaffe, because he gave them plenty of targets when sending over 5,000 into battle over Germany at least 10 times every month. One of our veterans here tonight, a Pathfinder pilot on his 20-something operation, I believe, was a Schrager Music victim. On the way back from Kiel, his Lancaster was blown on its back by an attack and then broke up, with he and three of his crew trapped inside the violently spinning half aircraft in a vertical descent. He believes the canopy gave way and pitched them out just in time to use their parachutes. He was 23 years old. Over the target area, there were minutes of dry mouths, but the kind Air Force did give us some chewing gum. There was sweating palms, shaky voices as the bomb emmer intoned, left, left, right, steady, right, steady, and not many continued with, whoa, back a bit. With every crew praying for those blessed words, bombs gone. The defenses around the German targets were formidable. More than 50,000 flak guns, including 15,000 deadly 88mm guns, probably the best artillery piece of the war, protected their cities. And they would have been invaluable as anti-tank guns in Russia or Normandy. 900,000 men manned the defenses, and a further 1 million people were deployed in clearing up and repairing the bomb damage. And by 1944, 80% of their aircraft production went to fighters, all due to the bomber offensive. The weather was also a factor. We had no weather radar, and unforeseen involvement with vicious cumulonimbus clouds could break a bomber. Remember what happened 2 weeks ago to that French airliner. And unexpected wind changes could disrupt a raid and imperil returning crews. Now, our airmen were the best of the country's young men in physical health, in intelligence, in learning quickly how to operate their aircraft and their equipment, and in their patriotism. Most lived on wartime airfields, in drafty, cold Nissen huts with primitive ablutions, surrounded by mud in winter, and with dispersal run riot. The hangars, flight offices, briefing rooms, parachute and clothing sections were all far apart, which meant a lot of walking. And they were up against a resolute, brave, skillful, and technically inventive enemy, grimly defending his homeland as we did ours in 1940. The victory we won was hard won. It took years of endeavor and struggle, and a dreadful price had to be paid. And that price was the lives of our young aircrew, who were all volunteers. One example, Bomber Command's worst night of the war, a raid against Nuremberg on the 30th of March 1944, when 95 bombers were chopped down out of 795 dispatched, and more were badly damaged. We lost 665 trained airmen in that one night, more than Fighter Command lost in the 4 months of the Battle of Britain. As chairman of the Bomber Command Association, I thank you for coming tonight and showing your support for our campaign to build a memorial to our bomber crews. Late? Yes, late, but not too late. To build a memorial worthy of their massive contribution to final victory to secure our freedom and the liberation of Europe, and to the enormity of their sacrifice. So let me leave you with these thoughts. A few words from the funeral oration of Pericles at the burial of his young Athenians killed in the defense of their city. Pericles was a famous Athenian naval commander and statesman who lived 2,500 years ago. And I believe they ring as true today in memory of our fallen comrades of Bomber Command. Take these men for your example and remember, posterity can only be for the free. And that freedom is the sure possession of those alone who have the courage to defend it.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum.